Welcome to Culture, Talent, and Growth. Join Anish Shah and the Ruckus team as they invite dynamic leaders to share what they've learned about creating lasting culture, attracting great talent, and achieving sustainable growth. Let's get started.
Hello, thank you for joining us today. I'm really excited about our conversation today with Aaron Luo, who is the CEO and co-founder of Mercado Famous, and a European gourmet food brand that specializes in Spanish delicacies, which I've had the opportunity to try, and they're absolutely delicious. Aaron is also the CEO and co-founder of Kara, which is an American design house of luxury accessories based in New York City. Aaron, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Really excited to dive into both brands and all the topics that we're gonna discover and chat through. So thanks for having me on the show.
Awesome. I'm so excited to dive in. Right off the bat, I would love if you could share with us the story behind the name Mercado Famous. I love the name itself. I love the branding on top of the products being so delicious. But how did you come up with the name and what does it represent for your brand?
So a little bit of background about myself, because I think it ties into how we started with the name. So I'm Chinese, grew up in Shanghai, but afterwards really spent most of my teen years in Spain before coming to the States for college and school and work and all that. But really spent over a decade in Spain, Madrid specifically. And my co-founder, Carmen Chen Wu, she was born in Valencia, grew up in Spain. We met together in New York and have a bunch of ventures together. We actually are also co-founders of Kara, which you mentioned before, which is a luxury handbag brand based also out of New York. The initial genesis behind how we started Mercado Famous was because we were frustrated to not be able to find, you know, one of the best delicacies from Spain, which is the charcuterie in the States. And when I say charcuterie, it's jamón, it's chorizo, it's salchichón, it's lomo. And those are things that we grew up with, right? Eating in Spain. And we just were really, really struggling finding, you know, the same quality of product in the States, or we could find them, but at a very, very high cost. So we say, hey, look, we know for a fact that American consumers have an appetite for these kind of products. Just look at our counterparts from Italy, right? When you think about the charcuteries from Italy, prosciutto and all the different delicacies that Italians bring to the States, it's a widely penetrated category in the American pantries. There's a lot of reason why I think the Spanish charcuteries are not as penetrated as the Italian ones, but you know, we definitely knew that there's definitely a market out there. It's just a matter of presenting a product and a brand that resonates more with the American consumers. And when we start digging into the actual space a little bit, you know, and I don't want to kind of badmouth any brands, but in general, right, when we look at the overall category, everything just felt very heritage, very like Boar's Head, for lack of words, right? Very Oscar Mayer. And again, there's a huge population and target audience for it. Hence, those brands are gigantic for that reason. But once again, we just felt that I think there's room for, you know, a lot more non-ostentatious, good quality, a little bit more inclusive type of brands when it comes to Spanish charcuterie. The reason we call it Mercado Famous is ultimately we wanted to build actually an American brand, but without a doubt, it's going to be from Spain. So hence we selected a name, and our team did a fantastic job working with us to brainstorm the different names that we can use. But we knew we wanted to have a Spanish component, right, in the name, hence the word Mercado. But at the same time, we wanted to actually have an English or American component to it, which is famous. So those things to combine, we just wanted to have something that represents somewhat of a global or two-country representation, I guess, while still it's very much understood that it is something originally from Spain, hence the Spanish heritage of the word Mercado.
I love it. That's so smart. And it's cool to know that you were working with a team that kind of walked you through a bunch of different options that I imagine fulfilled that nod to Spain and the nod to the American market, and that this is what you landed on.
Yeah, no, it was a very fun exercise. If you ever had a chance, or any of the listeners ever had a chance to actually go through a branding naming exercise, it's a little bit like a soul searching. Because before you land on any name in general, right, I think the conversation, it's always geared towards who you are, what's your value proposition, like at the core of your brand, what are you trying to do or who you want to be in the world? Which is very philosophical, very spiritual, very agonizing to a certain extent, because, you know, we hardly ever actually, I think, stop and thinking about those questions. But, you know, once we actually spend the time and really did that soul searching, like I mentioned before, I think then putting names on paper and selecting those names becomes fun. So, yeah, it was a great exercise, which honestly was the foundation of our branding.
Absolutely. I love that. I'm such a big fan of go-to-market brand work. And I feel like it's so often for me, the question is like, how do you want your customer to feel when they're interacting with your brand? And it seems like that was really at the root of what you were creating as well.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because if you really kind of unpack our branding a little bit, right? And just kind of digging into a little bit of who Mercado Famous is. Historically speaking, when we looked at a lot of other CPG brands or charcuterie brands in general, especially when it comes to Spanish charcuterie, everything felt almost like an occasion, a celebration, which is not a bad thing, right? But the underlying tone behind a lot of brands is almost like, hey, you got to go out there and find this Chateau 96, and you got to get the candles ready, and you got to like white everything in the table set, and it's like the whole thing, right? And we said, great. I mean, the product is good enough to celebrate those occasions, but we wanted something that's a little bit less ostentatious and something that's a lot more inclusive. So if you look at our branding, right, you first thing you see when you go to our website is this guy and girl with tattoos and celebrating a meal together, right? A lot of our content is very loud, very fun. And what we're trying to say is this, like, look, you know, celebrate the fire you want. At the end of the day, when I think about the success of Mercado Famous, for us, it's not about selling more meat. For us, it's about educating and bringing a piece of Spanish culture into the American society or the American consumers. That's ultimately what we're trying to accomplish. Food is a vehicle where a lot of Spaniards, right, the way we grew up, it's something that brought us together. It's a platform. It's a vehicle that kind of united us when we come together and celebrate just togetherness. And that's kind of the branding behind Mercado Famous, right? Is that, look, go out there, crack a beer, crack a Bud Light, whatever you have in the fridge, take a piece of white bread, if that's what you have, whatever cheese you like, and then eat it with your friends or any other way that you consume it, right? That's kind of the way we like to celebrate the brand and introduce the brand. So yeah, so a lot of time and effort went into creating the name and the branding behind how we want to go to the market. And we're very proud of what the result currently looks like.
Absolutely. I think it definitely feels accessible in the ways that all of the ways that you're describing, but I love that it also is so beautiful. Like I can't imagine feeling the need to take a picture of the meat that I'm taking out of some of the other brands that you've mentioned. But when I sat down, I had a little picnic with the charcuteries that I got to taste from you all. And I absolutely felt like I needed to take a picture of the packaging before I took it out, just because it's so stunning, but not in a way that makes it feel inaccessible or like I have to save it for this like special fancy occasion, but just in a way that makes the little moments really, really beautiful.
No, thank you for saying that. We've seen, since we launched last year, we've seen so many interesting and heartwarming stories from our customers through the UGC content they've shared with us. And a lot of it is through charcuterie board, like you mentioned, which of course the product itself looks beautiful by itself over the packaging. One of my favorite actual UGC that I recently saw not that long ago, is this couple from Brooklyn in York, that were just basically going for a quick picnic, nothing big in the local park. And they brought a little bit of drink, a few pieces of bread, and then just kind of a few packages of Mercado Famous as a snack. And just kind of like their own they go snacking, having fun, chilling. That's honestly like, I'm like, that is somebody who we actually able to touch and really kind of took our product and actually consume it in his own way, in a very natural, fun, cool, non-ostentatious way. So thank you for saying that. We We love seeing those moments when our customers share those with us.
Truly, truly. So it seems like your decade or so that you spent living in Madrid had a really incredible influence on everything that you have created now with Mercado Famous. Can you share some of your fondest memories that involve Spanish charcuterie and how that kind of tied into what you are hoping to create, those moments that you're hoping to create for your customers?
Yeah, the best moments of childhood, I think, from Madrid is sharing the charcuteries, whether it's jamón, chorizo, any of the charcuterie I mentioned before, with friends in the park, in the restaurant, whatever we're hanging out. And like I mentioned before, I think it was such a memorable vehicle for us, right? Is that when we had our first beer or when we had our first dinner as a team, when I was an athlete back in high school. Yeah, I remember one of the first dinners we had as a major team had jamón or charcuterie in there. Of course, in Spain, all the charcuterie I mentioned before, it's a prominent part of our daily diet. So it's very available everywhere. Any Spanish restaurant you go to, unless they're only serving seafood, they always have these kind of appetizers or these kind of food available for ordering. And that's ultimately kind of what we miss. Like in the States, I feel like sharing a meal, and again, I'm not trying to generalize. I think there's a lot of family that treats and approaches meal very differently. But our experience, especially in a very busy city like New York or a lot of coastal cities that we visited, it's almost like I don't think people take enough time enjoying their meal with their friends, right? And I personally, I can share a story. Not that long ago, we went out with my in-laws and we went to this pretty decent, fancy restaurant. You kind of know we had appetizers, drink, meal, dessert. And after dessert, it's immediately, well, where are we going next? And let's get the checklist bounce, right? And that would never happen in Spain, right? In terms of like you going to a restaurant to enjoy company meal, it's a vehicle to actually have conversation on the food that you're having. So you have your drinks, you have your appetizer, main meal, dessert. But then we're talking about first aperitif, maybe another drink, maybe, you know, another set of dessert or snack. But we're talking about perhaps even an hour after the meal is done, you're still there hanging out and have conversation with your friends or loved ones, wherever you're there with. And honestly, that's kind of what we miss the most in from Spain, from Madrid, for living there. And that's kind of the atmosphere and the overall mood we're trying to create with Mercado in terms of, look, buy the meat, try the meat. It's delicious, of course, and we stand behind it. And there's a lot of things in the supply chain side of why we're so proud of the product itself. But ultimately, it's meant for you to consume it with your loved ones and enjoy the time together.
So powerful. And I think it really makes me think about like when you're in a big American city and you sit down for a reservation and the first thing that they say is like, just so you know, your table's up in 90 minutes. It's like, first of all, I just got here. Like,
I know. It's crazy. And I get it, right? I think the life rhythm in the States, it's a lot different. Of course, it varies a little bit state by state. Where I live in New York is you always hear this thing of time is money, right? It's like, oh, go, go, go. And I think we kind of sometimes miss the point of taking a step back and enjoying the moment. And I think food can, in general, can actually do that. One thing that I had to really get used to when I moved to the States for the first time is like, after meal, my expectation is like, we're going to be here for another hour and a half and chatting. And most of my colleagues and friends is like, okay, you know, we go home or go to the next spot. So totally. It's interesting.
Absolutely. So you have about a decade of experience in corporate finance before getting into entrepreneurship, right?
Yep.
Can you talk to me about what motivated the pivot from finance to fashion with your other company, Cara, and then now into the food industry, and then how your background in finance has been helpful in both of these ventures?
Yeah. So, you know, my family has always been in entrepreneurship or entrepreneurs themselves, both my co-founder and I. So our family has been currently, it's even involved in real estate. It's in global supply chain, manufacturing, in the fashion side. And that's why ultimately we took a plunge going to Cara from the fashion side, just because my family has been involved in global supply chain for luxury handbags for three decades. So after business school, always knew that I wanted to eventually, right, take the entrepreneurial route or entrepreneurship route with the right idea or the right concept. However, I'm a strong believer in first understanding how to properly operate a business. I was pretty well educated, I think, in terms of my education, but truth to be told, after business school, especially, I mean, even after bachelor's, right? Back then, if you ask me what a CEO did, I'll probably tell you, I have no clue. I have no clue what a C-suite did. I have no clue what they, like, all, like back then, you get a concept of, like, you get into a lot of meetings, you manage a lot of different things, but you really don't understand what the playbook really is, right? So I'm like, look, you know, even if I have the best idea in the world, right, as an entrepreneur, if ultimately I don't know how to operate a business, which I think I'm an operator ultimately, right, I'm not going to be successful. So I specifically, it was interesting. For me, it was really kind of three businesses that I really wanted to join after school. And General Electric was one of the key businesses that I was dying to get into. I got exposed to Jack Welch's Six Sigma mentality, a lot of the methodologies, managerial methodologies that he had, which of course now in hindsight probably is not going to work with the current environment. But back then, that was the one managerial methodology that I really attracted to. And for the decade I spent with GE, which probably one of the best decades I spent as a professional, I was very much involved in operations, technology, and ultimately finance. What they really taught me, it's about risk management at the end of the day, right? It's how do I look at risk? How do I leverage risk? How do I mitigate risk? Of course, all of that translates into financials, right? You basically build risk into a lot of financial models that you do. And that was probably the number one thing I walked away from in my corporate days, is that when I look at businesses in general, how do I identify risk? How do I, again, manage around that for good and for bad? Corporate in general, but specifically GE, helped me understand the power of people. And that's what I spend a lot of time on currently. And back then when I was with the with GE, is how important the function of human resources is and how important it is to build a pipeline, grow your people and hire right, and then grow them over time, or grow people over time into certain roles and ultimately have a very strong bench to help you scale as a brand. Those two key things, I think, both from the financial side, on the risk side, and also people management, probably ultimately is the two things that walked away being the biggest golden nuggets. And of course, there's an infinite number of lessons learned over the decade I spent. I was fortunate enough to touch a lot of different businesses within GE, not just one. So tons of lessons, but really those two things ultimately helped me to take the jump into Kara first. I know it's a long way to answer your question. That was honestly the reason why I wanted to join a Fortune 500 company, to take those lessons to help me form myself as a professional. And then, of course, later on, ultimately, when I jumped and started Kara, we had the idea, we had a supply chain background. I knew ultimately, operationally, I could manage it based on experience. It also just gave me a lot of confidence, right? Is that, you know, after being able to manage $1 billion P&L, right? Like, I think, and a lot of my colleagues give me a hard time. It's like, how do you go from managing locomotives, aircraft engines, and healthcare equipment to selling handbags at the beginning? And I say, hey, listen, I'm really happy what I'm doing, and honestly, that's both businesses have their own merit, of course, but it was great to learn from all those brands and different divisions that I was able to touch back in my GE days.
Absolutely. Those seem like really transferable skills and wisdom to be able to bring from one to the next to the next. And I know obviously they're different industries, different audiences, but to be a multi-passionate business person allows you to take those skill sets and bring them to all of the areas that excite you. And I think it sounds like that's really what you have done.
Yeah, no, I'm really happy how things turned out. I probably wouldn't have done anything different. Like recently I had a mentoring a couple of kids and they asked me, it's like, what would you have done differently if you're looking back? I mean, I guess if the one thing I would say is probably, I would probably pull the trigger sooner. That's a little bit of, you never know when is the right time to jump the ship. To a certain extent, I'll pull the trigger. I cherish every second I spend in my corporate day just because I got a ton of learnings in those areas that I mentioned, risk management, operations, technology, and finance. So yeah, it was really good. And look, hats off to a lot of entrepreneurs out there. I always say this, that perhaps didn't really have that kind of background in training, but still made a huge impact growing their business or be able to actually scale the business over time. That's some natural talent. I knew I wasn't that talented and I needed the training to help me get here. But yeah, when I see those entrepreneurs that kind of just right after college start starting on brands, it's impressive.
Truly, that's a great point. When you speak to supply chain management, and which I think is such a crucial aspect of so many businesses, those that are sourcing internationally, like Mercado Famous, like Kara, it sounds like you have, I mean, gained a lot of wisdom through your own experience, but also come from a family that maybe had some insight into that for you as well. I think this is a really intimidating piece of starting a company for a lot of people who would love to be sourcing products or creating products, but are afraid to get their hands dirty in this capacity. Do you have any advice for founders that are looking to get into international supply chains or start a business where that would be a really core part of what they need to manage?
Yeah, that's huge. I always say that if you don't have supply chain lockdown, you don't have a business, no matter how strong your idea is. I'm talking about product brands, right? Of course, service brands, which still you can argue there's a supply chain component to it. But you know, when you're selling a product and you have a shaky supply chain, your risk of failure is very, very high. I think for us looking back, Kara, we had a little bit of unfair advantage, to be honest with you, because of my family's background, right? So we went into the conversation already with the credibility and with the connections that we needed to really have very preferred terms in terms of payment terms, in terms of quantity, and keep the quantity as minimum as you can so that it doesn't impact your cash flow. So we already have a little bit of unfair advantage. Of course, we had to prove that we're serious, that a lot of factories might give you a first order, but if they see there's no longevity in actually working with you, they will move away or they would deprioritize you, right? If you're dealing with either any kind of supplier or factory. So I think if you have any kind of connection already with an existing supplier, just keep in mind that first order don't always translate to second order. You always have to be proving, especially in the early days, that you're somewhat of a quote unquote worthy partner for your supplier and make sure that you have a very tight relationship with them. So that's probably number one. When it comes to Mercado, we took 2 years to actually find the right supply chain partner that has the right farm, that has the right recipe in terms of how you cure the meats, that has the right practices and ethics in terms of how you treat your animals, how you sacrifice them. So, you know, we're very proud of Mercado Famous for that reason alone, just because we partner with a century-old farm that has this capability to scale with us. But the reality is that there were a lot of smaller farms that we really loved in Spain that we contemplated to work with, but they had 100 pigs. What are you going to do with 100 pigs? Like, there's not a lot of scale you can actually do, right? And of course, we want to position Mercado Famous to go mass eventually, right, in terms of the scalability of it. So it was important to find the right partner that was able to actually scale with us based on the current kind of supply chain footprints. And the advice I would probably give is that whatever you do when you're trying to establish a supply chain, make sure that you spend a lot of time on the ground with them, especially if it's international, right? Whether it's Europe or Asia, buy a plane ticket, book a hotel for a chunk of time, be on the ground with them and get to know them and ask silly questions, ask hard questions, build the relationship and the credibility that you need, because they are the backbone of your business at the end of the day when you come back to the States. So I think that's probably number one. It's a very much a relationship-based conversation, and you need to basically do your part as far as creating those relationships, especially from the early days. I also think that it's whatever you can, if you can afford it, always good to have somebody on the ground that after you leave, because I'm assuming we're talking about with American entrepreneurs, that you have somebody on the ground that can actually be the day-to-day with a person or with a supply chain partner that you end up selecting. It just speeds up so many different things as far as production, quality management, shipping, consolidation of shipment. I mean, there's so much to it that if you can afford it, which I think it's a wise investment, you can find somebody local. That's something that I will always suggest to a person to do, to have a local office and a local presence, especially dealing with international supply chain. So that's probably two of the key things that really helped us is finding the right partner through relationship and really kind of do due diligence as far as who you want to work with. And then once you make that bet, right, in terms of who you want to end up working with, is to have a local representative that's part of your team. I'm not talking about brokers. I'm talking about somebody on salary that you hire that's actually a satellite office that you establish in a local country to help you actually manage the local day-to-day. So I think without that, you lose so much attention to details. I mean, you can't manage a global supply chain from the States. This is very difficult. So that's probably my biggest advice.
Yeah, such valuable takeaways there. I think especially I love the call out about wanting to find partners who you'll be able to scale with as well, and not thinking about these as short-term partnerships, but instead really wanting to have, wanting to see them grow with you and wanting to see them be able to continue to meet the needs as your audience exponentially explodes as well.
100%. That's why I think having that initial due diligence is so important, right? It's to not just to build a relationship, but also get a glimpse into the practices, perhaps get a glimpse into their financials if you have access to it. And also, of course, of the current footprint in terms of supply chain. It's very risky, right? And I have so many nightmare stories from our end or from people that we have worked with in the past on the carrier side, where you've been working, even partners that you've been working with for a while, you've been working with them for a while, and for whatever reason, when things happen, they all of a sudden go out of business. Sometimes with some kind of deposit that you already put it down. Sometimes perhaps not even with a deposit you put it down, but they just go out of business. And suddenly now a chunk of your production has to be moved to somebody else, which often doesn't happen that quickly. So that's why I said, unless you have a person on the ground that can see that, right, day to day, is like, hey, these guys are moving, or, right, like little things like that that you actually can really grasp if you're not local. I think by having the local presence to represent you and feed you the local intelligence, it's extremely important.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people imagine that is a piece that they can just kind of plug in, set it up with signs and paperwork virtually, and then trust that it's going to take care of itself. But I think what I'm hearing from you is that this is the most essential part of your business. And if you're going to invest anywhere, this is where you need to invest, is making sure that your supply chain is really secure, really taken care of, that you're paying attention to the details.
100%. You don't have a business unless you have a solid supply chain. And that's what we always say, is that the effectiveness of your supply chain can help you drive your costs down, can help you improve your product quality, and save you a lot of headaches in terms of recalls or defects, things that can actually happen down the road. That I think, to me, everything starts, again, I'm a little biased depending on the business, but I would say everything starts with design. I think both for Kara and also for Mercado, I think designing the product itself is very important. The product is the queen or is the king, but really kind of supply chain aspect of it is really kind of your bread and butter to ensure that you have a successful brand and business.
Of course. I love that. To be the co-founder and CEO of one successful company is a feat. To be the co-founder and CEO of two successful companies simultaneously is, I mean, incredible to say the least, but I would love to just understand, like, what do your days look like? How do you wear all of these hats and do it so well?
Yeah, it's a tough question. And I think I'm still figuring that out a little bit myself. Definitely have some golden nuggets. I can share kind of what I'm trying to do to balance all that, right? And I think we briefly chatted about this before. I think I fully grasp, we all read Steve Jobs' biography and never really fully understood what is it like to manage two brands like he did at one point between Apple and Pixel. And it's a beast. It's a lot, right? So for me, I think staying organized, of course, comes by default, right? And having the rigor to actually have, you know, run your calendar in a daily basis. That's a tactical thing that I think we all have to do, whether you're running one business or no business or three business, whatever it is. I think I draw into my training a lot back from my GE days in terms of staying. Planning is key. I think running two businesses, especially one that's just starting, right? Mercado Famous launched last year, so it's very thirsty of attention. I think as much as we can plan, it's probably what's really kind of helping us really staying organized. And when I say plan, I'm talking about starting with financial planning. So we have short range planning, operating planning, 1 year planning, and what we call growth playbook, which is 3 year planning. So everything starts with financial planning, looking at risk, P&L, balance sheet, all that every single month, every single quarter. And from there, it's when we start planning as far as operations, when we're launching new products, what does the marketing calendar look like? So again, we try to balance between too many tools and charts versus not planning at all. But that's probably the one thing that's really keeping us extremely organized as a brand for both as far as planning goes. And again, I think as a business, if you, no matter how small or big you are, if you don't have the right level of financial planning on a monthly or quarterly basis, you are very much, you're very much, I think, handicapped as far as be able to scale or stay organized. That's the first thing I say. Hiring has been a challenge, but nevertheless, one key thing that's really helping us or helping me, I try to delegate as much as I can. And it's a little bit of a tough thing to do, especially when you're dealing with a smaller emerging brand, right? Just because you feel like you need to be touching everything, you know, everything is very important and I don't want to delegate or that person's going to mess it up and so on and so forth. I think that's why we spend so much time hiring and looking for the right person for different roles, because once we find the right person in the role, we expect them to basically be superstars. And so we delegate as much as we can. So I think, especially for the first 5 to 10 employees within any brands, I think it's extremely important to find the right people that you can delegate to. So I was fortunate enough to actually have a really good infrastructure of teams that I work with. And I was able to delegate a lot of things on my plate. So that's probably number two things I would say. On the personal side, it's tough because I knew the work never ends. So I can be working 24 hours a day and things will still never get done. And that affects my emotional health. It affects my actual health, physical health. So for me, so look, I'm an athlete. So I practice fencing. So that's my escape. I did fencing in high school, did fencing in college, took a break during my corporate days just because it was so busy, I couldn't really do it. After I started Kara, I got into Muay Thai, which is a Thai kickboxing. And then I started picking up fencing again. And eventually I just kind of mainly focused on fencing and I still compete at the national level. And that's my escape. That's my escape in terms of, you know, what I try to do is at least 4 to 5 times a day, I mean, a week, you know, I try to go train, whether it's in my club, whether it's doing conditioning and strength. Just need to block that 3 hours, 3.5 hours a day where I need to just basically forget about all the stress and then focus on getting better and beating the guy in front of me. Such an escape. I think it brings such a balance to my day to day in terms of work that I think for any CEO or senior management out there, I encourage everybody to find that balance, whatever that balance is. It doesn't always have to be sport, I think. If your thing is painting or bird watching, I have an executive on my team that her thing is rock climbing, and which is a beautiful sport. And you know, I said, please, like, spend as much of your time to balance all the hecticness that happens at work with your personal mental health, just because I think it's impossible for all of us to balance so many different things without having that counterbalance on the mental personal side.
Yeah. There are so many founders who, like, their downtime or their me time is just reading business books, right? And it's like, sure, like, yes, that might be, I mean, yes, it's a shift in the way that you're spending your time, but you're still just churning your brain about your business.
Your business, that's right. Books, I agree. I agree. It has to be something that's totally unrelated, right, to your business.
It gets you out of your head. Like, I love the examples that you said, you like both like fencing, rock climbing, and painting, bird watching. Like, those are all things that, whether you're getting into your body or doing something that's a little bit more creative and meditative, like, it just gives you an opportunity to not be so firmly in that logic mindset that I think our founders can spend, like you said, 24 hours a day really turning on those business ideas.
100%. I mean, look, at the end of the day, right, especially for our line of work as founders and executives in general, a lot of it's mental. Everything is in our head. And because of that, it's almost like a curse and a bless, right? And the bless in the sense that, yes, constantly thinking and making yourself better, but it's a curse because it's hard to shut it off, right? Because it's in mind. You could be even taking vacations. Like, when I take vacations, whenever I could take them, take me 3 days just to detox. And then the fourth day, maybe I start thinking about, hey, let's go do something cool and fun, right? But for the first 3 days, I'm thinking, gosh, what is the next quarter going to look like? Gosh, what's the supply negotiation going to look like? And all the things that goes in your head. I think having those daily scapes, like you mentioned before, like we were talking about, fencing, taking that as an example, doing the fencing bout or sparring, right? Basically, you're going against your opponent. For that 10 minutes that bout lasts, you think nothing but to get a touch on him and not to get touched. So you don't think about P&L, you don't think about hiring, you don't think, and that's such, I think, relief and a balance that I think all of us need, that I think being present in something other than business, I think, is honestly necessary and critical for the well-being of any well-rounded executive.
Couldn't agree more. Could not agree more. My last question for you, just circling back to Mercado Famous, you have so many delicious products, and your website, one of the things that I love about your website is that it features dozens of recipes that show us all of the different ways that you can use them. But I would love to know which of the Mercado Famous charcuteries is your go-to and what your favorite way to eat it is.
Yeah, no, that's tough. So much. First of all, thank you for pointing out the recipes. For us, again, first and foremost, we're a Spanish brand in the States, but we also are very international by background, by default, right? I'm Chinese. And what's interesting, I mean, being Chinese growing up in Spain, is that a lot of actually ingredients that we cook in the Chinese dishes ends up using a lot of Spanish ingredients. So actually jamón, chorizo, and lomo, those are some of the charcuteries that we actually end up using for like a fried rice, often like a sauté egg dish with tomatoes, perhaps adding a little bit of jamón in there. So because of that experience growing up, and again, I hate the word fusion, but you know, having kind of that international mindset as far as be able to use a very typical ingredients for another cultural dish, like a Chinese dish, it was somewhat embedded in our heads as far as like, that's just normal, right, to do. So when we started Mercado Famous, we wanted to actually introduce to our audience different ways that you can use and enjoy these ingredients, jamón or chorizo, all the charcuteries, into a pizza, into an omelet, into a baked dish with asparagus. There's a lot of different dishes that we have already shared and will be sharing the next month or so. For me, I think as much as I love all of them, I would say probably Hamuyi Berry Gold is probably my go-to, right? But Hamuyi Berry Gold, it's often called the Wagyu of porks. Some people call it the king of porks. What's interesting about Hamuyi Berry Gold, just kind of digging out for a second there, is first of all, the pig itself, it's Iberian pig. So it comes from wild boar originally, but it's a very distinct type of pig that's very lean, and actually not a lot of fat. And the way we raise them, actually, it's free roam, especially for the last 8 months of their life. And what I mean with that is that we free roam them in the valleys, the mountains of Spain, and they only eat on what they can find on the ground. We don't feed them anything artificially, but because of the season, we'll let them roam free. The majority of their diet, probably more than 80% of their diet, is on acorn. And what's interesting about acorn as a nut is that it gives a very, very nutty flavor to the meat. So Hamuyi Iberico, the one I just mentioned, 100% Iberico, it's fed based on basically acorn. And when you eat it, for those of you who have tried it before, it gives this very umami, it's not salty at all, but it's very nutty flavor that's just exquisite. I mean, if you haven't ever tried it,
it's so good.
Nothing like it. And it's orgasmic. I mean, really, like when I think about this, it's so. And honestly, that was probably the number one product that was excited to introduce to the American consumers. And there's not a single person that tried this and is like, that's not really my cup of tea. I've actually had a vegetarian guy who's from my fencers club try. Well, he's pescatarian, so technically he does eat a little bit of meat. And we're hanging out, and I'm like, I brought some meat for you to try. And I mean, the look in his face when he tried it, it's like, wow. So probably that's my go-to. The way I like to eat it, probably it's just as is, with a glass of wine, just to respect the meat and let the meat kind of do its thing.
Yeah. Why mess with perfection?
That's right. But yeah, that's the, it's a tough question just because I think they're all my children and I love them all, but that's probably the number one item that I always gravitate towards.
Absolutely. I'm a chorizo girl, so I knew, yeah, I was going to love that. And the lobo I also was delicious, but I didn't know the history of like jamón ibérico. And I'm not the biggest prosciutto person, so I was assuming that I wouldn't be obsessed with the jamón, but it was amazing. I was like,
it really is. You know, and it's interesting. To your point, I think a lot of people compare that with prosciutto, which I mean, by default, because it looks similar, but it's a whole different ballgame, right?
Totally,
right? Because look, when you look at the prosciutto, even if you look at the best prosciutto, the one from the Parma, it's a different pig. It's a white pig versus the Iberian pig that I was telling you about, which is fine. But the white pig is a lot fatter. And the reality is that you don't really know where they come from in terms of the lineage. Versus the Iberico pigs, it's regulated by the government. Each of them have basically a DNA heritage tag that proves that these are Iberian pigs. So you actually have to prove that these are Iberian descendants with a clear lineage, who's the father, who's the grandfather, and so on and so forth.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's very regulated. In terms of creation process, the creation for Iberico is 18 months plus, up to 24 months, versus a prosciutto, it's a lot younger creation, usually I think up to 6 to 8 months. So that's the reason why prosciutto is a lot saltier of a meat, because you don't have a lot of time to cure the meat. So you use salt to actually accelerate to make sure the meat's eatable.
Yeah.
Versus ours is you basically let the time and a lot less salt, actually no salt at all during the curation process to let the meat actually cure. So it's similar, but honestly, it's like comparing, I mean, they both are fruits, I guess, if you want to call it that way, but it's apples to oranges for sure.
No, definitely. I think it's, for me, it was really just the look of it. Like they're sliced similarly. So in my head, I was comparing them, but the texture, the flavor, the fat percentage is completely different. And I think for me, it makes all the difference. I'm like not the biggest prosciutto fan, but I will never say no to jamón now.
No, it's I couldn't agree more. And thank you for for trying and sharing those words, because I think we honestly, having lived in so many different countries, one of the theses that we had, we were convinced of, is that the American consumers, if anything, jamón specifically, will love it. It's just because that's such a unique, mild profile to it. And given the fact that Italian food, like I mentioned before, it's already penetrated in terms of charcuterie, I think this will blow people's socks off.
You want to know what? I'm embarrassed. I was in Barcelona last summer with my family. Nice. And my brother and my cousin were like the only two boys on the trip, and they could not pass a single store that was selling the jamón sandwiches without stopping, going in and grabbing one. They were obsessed. But in my mind, I was thinking it was just like the Spanish name for prosciutto. So I wasn't even trying it. I'm like, I have to go back and eat my way through Spain again. Like,
you got to come back. You got to come back and try them. And it, to your point, it's everywhere, right? Like, it's
everywhere. They were stopping twice a block to get a sandwich.
That's right. That's right. And I'm assuming they're talking about like bocadillos, right? Or like a smaller
little loaf. Yes.
Yeah. Oh my God. So good. And that's what I'm telling you before, is that we grew up on those things, right? It represented comfort. It represented gatherness and friendship and family. And we just kind of missed that. I want to share a piece of that with our friends and families here in the States. So
I love it. Now that I think about it, I'm going to go order some for my brother and my cousin, since they loved it so much. I'm sure they would love their get a little.
There we go. I'm interested to hear what they say, even once they try it.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much, Aaron. This was such a fun conversation. It's amazing to just learn about your journey as a co-founder and CEO, and to really get to understand the incredible things that you are building. I'm excited to see what is next for Mercado Famous, what's next for Kara, and what's ahead for you as well. But thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun, Casey, talking about all those topics. And looking forward to keep you posted of all the fun things coming up.
Yes, please do.
Thanks for tuning in to Culture, Talent, and Growth. If you found value in this conversation, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. You can visit bringruckus.com for more ways to connect. And remember, new episodes come out on Tuesday.